Well, if I've been listening carefully, and I think I have, Stephen LaBerge and Dominic Sante, I'll get that right, are telling us that that all of our dreams are actually rooted in reality, and that we cannot dream or have a perturbation of something that is real without it having been rooted in reality. And then it can take off from there and virtually go anywhere. Now, that seems to collide a little bit with a lot of people who claim that whether it's out-of-body experiences or dreams that give them other insights, believe they're taken to some other magical land or some other dimension. But they seem to be saying, we don't necessarily believe that, or certainly we don't have evidence of that. So when we get back with Dominic, I'm going to let all of you ask questions, and maybe some of you will take us further down that road and to a point that I haven't taken us yet. I'm Art Bell, Dominic Adesanyi, coming up with your questions next. That's why I mentioned precognitive dreams. Once again, here is Dominic Adesanyi. Dominic, I didn't do a very good job of saying what I wanted to say there at the top of this hour. But what I'm getting from what the both of you said in the first, you know, couple of hours of this interview is that we can derive great pleasure from lucid dreaming, learning to control our own dreams, sort of being a director of our own dreams to some extent. And that's certainly a positive thing to be able to do, and I'd love to be able to do it. But dreams are not taking us into some magical, truly different place. And what we dream of is a variation of the reality that we've experienced, not some magical floating to the other side of the world and actually hearing what's going on, not some precognitive experience or something of that sort, but all based in reality. And that's why I asked about the blind or the deaf. Is that a fair assessment?
I'd be careful about making it too reductionist to say it's a small reality we're talking about. I think there's a very, very magical aspect of the bigger reality that we do reach into, but I think sometimes our interpretations are too simplistic. We do think that you can perceive things beyond the physical senses that we count on our five digits today. The fact that remote viewing has been experimentally proven both in a laboratory with waking subjects and in lucid dreams shows there's more than just the small reality that we walk around with day to day.
Has it been proven to your satisfaction? Are you really satisfied that remote viewers are really doing what they say they're doing?
Yep. In fact, I think Stephen might have been a skeptic in the late 80s before he himself was one of the quote-unquote lab rats working himself in the lab with Joe and others. And had his own remote viewing, lucid dreams, bringing back anomalous information that was no way accessible except through remote viewing.
Well, and that just blows it right back in the other direction.
Well, that's why I said I'd be careful about taking us too literally when we critique the way that people articulate what they think is going on. When I take issue with the classical description of the out-of-body experience, it's generally not that you're feeling like you're, I don't take issue with the feeling you're out of your body, nor that you can get anomalous information. But people want to leap to the next assertion or assumption that there's some material that physically leaves the body, based primarily on either a Greek, Christian background in religion that suggests that, you know, there's, I think Plato liked to talk about the forms and the way you get higher and higher away from the base and closer to the forms, the more implied spirituality you have. Or in the Christian tradition, having a soul, something that leaves the body that's seated somewhere in the pineal gland or the mind, seems a bit simplistic. And so we think there's a lot more out there, but we grasp models that have been sort of ingrained through education and through our culture. And we're not sure those are the right operative models to really understand how wide reality and the being can be.
Okay. All right. I could come up with a million more questions, but I'm going to turn it to the audience. Joe in Salt Lake City, you're on the air with Dominic. Hi.
Hey, Art, I just want to thank you for everything. You've really enriched my life. I have two questions real quick. Just wondering, in Dominic's research, if they ever experienced two people entering the dream state, sharing a dream, coming out of it, writing down their observations, and then had them coincide so that they...
Huh?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And then my second question...
No, wait. Okay. That's such a good one. Let's tackle that.
That's a mutual dream. They're very, very common. When we're at dream camp, I like to call it boot camp, we usually have 15 or 20 people in the same room working very hard for 10 days on dreaming, and lucid dreaming in particular. And very frequently, we'll have people talking about having a dream of somebody else in the room, and lots of correlations. I can't say that the correlations in the reports are provable that there is a telepathy going on, because most descriptions are of, we were in the same room talking about this and that, which is in fact the conversation topic we were having that afternoon in the lecture. So there's a lot of commonalities that come up, but whether to say that's telepathy or not, I can't say that we have proven it in the laboratory, although we do know that there is something called telepathy, as there is something called remote viewing. So there's no reason why it can't occur. But I think once I say that now, people will run off and say, well, I had a dream of you last night, you were in my dream, and therefore it must have been a telepathic experience. I think that's the jump that we make on every one of our experiences that can be dangerous, or at least can be deluding. Dangerous, perhaps, is an overreach.
Okay.
Next question.
Have you ever used DMT, ayahuasca, psilocybin, peyote, shamanism, anything like that?
All right, let's say chemicals. All right.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
More in my later years than my younger years, which is, I think, different than many in my age group. Specifically in research, ayahuasca I've used, upwards of 40 times, mostly in experimental contexts in Brazil. It was part of the work we did with the Lucidity Institute. Right now it's unpublished. We were trying to determine whether there was a real close correlation between lucid dreaming and the ayahuasca experience in specific. Because when you read the descriptions of the ayahuasca experience, it's usually said to be dreaming while awake, which is the superficial description we use of what lucid dreaming is, right? In fact, the experiences are similar but not the same. And when using ayahuasca or the other chemicals, you tend to have less control. I like to make the metaphorical comparison to something like I would do in deep meditation or using the Monroe technology, where it's sort of like gently floating down a stream on a metaphorical leaf, right? Down a current very, very gently, where the ayahuasca experience is more like being in a whitewater raft trying to hold on for dear life with your paddles.
Yeah.
Part of the experience. Very, very vivid. Much more visionary than some of the other chemicals that you rattled off. I have a lot of respect for plant teachers, but I'm not sure we want to say that it's a paranormal experience, at least in the sense that most people talk about it. Although I can tell you that the out-of-the-body sensations are quite striking using ayahuasca, where you don't find that as much with LSD or psilocybin.
Okay. Dominic, have you done any work with sensory deprivation?
I myself haven't. I think Stephen did some early work back in the late 80s. I think he's also worked with Gonsfield with Marilyn Schlitz at IONS. But I don't have a real good grasp of the material.
Darn it. I wished I'd asked earlier. all right. Sharon in Washington, you're on the air with Dominic.
Hi. I thank you for your show. I really, really enjoy your show. I'm an insomniac, and it's wonderful.
Thank you.
But my question is, could this be abused by people? Is there any instances where a person would want something that they don't have, or maybe they had before, and they learn this process, and they are not any longer satisfied or even made worse their life made worse by not having what they have in the dream that they can produce?
That's a good question, actually.
Yeah, that is a good question. First off, I think we should recognize that dreaming is natural. You do it 2 hours every night, and that generally just you don't remember it. All right. So lucid dreaming and dreaming are healthy, and there's nothing dangerous or untoward about them. But I would say that if you had a borderline personality disorder, or if you were an obsessive personality, that like anything else, you could become overly focused on one aspect of your life and existence than another. An extreme introvert might spend a lot of time playing his video games and not have a very good social life, and I think that's personally right. unhealthy. And I suppose that if you take anything to an extreme, trying to dream an extra 3 hours a night or lucid dream to the point where you avoid regular relationships during the day, I wouldn't call that psychologically healthful living. But like I said, I think those would be very extreme cases, and most of the time it takes some effort to focus on practicing lucid dreaming. So it's not something that you would do like drinking. It's easy to pick up a bottle every afternoon and get drunk. In fact, you can become an alcoholic very quickly. Lucid dreaming, as I said, it's natural, and it takes a little bit of intention setting. So you really do have to sit down and say, tonight I'm going to focus on it, this is my practice, and do it. Other nights, when you want to relax and not focus on trying to remember and write down your dreams, you don't lucid dream. And so I think there's a natural balance that occurs in most individuals.
And Dominic, I've noticed, and I bet a lot of the audience has too, that I tend to do more dreaming, or at least have more recollection of dreaming, when I'm in a more disturbed sleep state.
Yeah, I think it goes both ways. When you're disturbed, you'll have more what we call micro-awakenings. It turns out that every night you really awaken at least 7 or 8 times as you cycle through the 8-hour or 9-hour sleep process. Sure. You go down into stage 1, 2, 3, 4 sleep, and you start rising up in 90-minute cycles. As you rise up, there's a slight awakening that's generally right at the end of a REM period. So you start off in alpha, and you transition down to delta, and you come back up to alpha, beta. That's when you have your REM phases or REM sleep. So your awakening occurs just after REM or when you're dreaming. If you're being disturbed or you're unsettled, that micro-awakening may be extended, and you may have a brief few minutes of insomnia. And during that period, it's quite likely you'll remember that dream. And in fact, at Dream Camp, what we often do is tell people, look, you're here this week to do dream push-ups. We want you waking yourself up several times during the night, preferably at the end of your 90-minute dream sleep cycle, to pick up a dream. Does that help answer the question?
All right. Yes, I think it does. Now, one more, and this is a sort of off the beaten path here a little bit, but a lot of people, I'm sure, would like to know, is there a preferable amount of sleep that an individual should get every night? In other words, I hear a lot of people say, you know, as I get older, I don't sleep so many hours or need so much sleep. I, on the other hand, need a lot of sleep and get a lot of sleep.
Well, so first I should recommend that you get all the sleep you need. I think one of the biggest problems in today's workaday life, a lot of us are moving through the world with a large sleep debt. Debt meaning, you know, I need to pay it back, and so we fall asleep at the wheel. We don't pay attention to our teachers, friends, family, or coworkers, and we can get into trouble in various ways. So I think it's important to get what you need. Now, if you ask me normatively, what's the general required amount of sleep? Studies have shown it's basically 8.5 hours with, you know, under a bell curve, or no pun intended. So there's tales, people who need a little more, 9.5 hours. Some people need less, 6.5. The way to tell really is on a weekend, just sleep in, and maybe the next day clock yourself and see what your natural rise time is. If you are sleep deprived, you'll tend to accumulate a debt, and so it'll take several days to work that debt off before you can find the amount that your body needs.
But you can do that. You can work it off.
Yeah. Oh. There's a great book by William DeMint called The Promise of Sleep. He was one of Stephen's mentors, in fact, the father of sleep research. The book's extremely readable. It's rather lengthy, but there are several chapters in there about the normative aspects of sleep and the studies that show how they got to about 8.5 hours. With regard to people who say, you know, I need less sleep, or it's more disrupted as they move into the middle age and later years, yep, that's a part of normal aging. Hormone shift, melatonin shifts, your need for sleep does tend to decline a bit as you get into your 50s, 60s, and thereafter. People who needed 8.5 will tend to need 7, 7.5. Also, their sleep tends to be more fragmented, particularly in the early mornings as you get into your 60s and 70s. But again, that's a natural aspect of life.
Okay. Jeff in Rochester, New York, you're on with Dominic. Hi.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. I have a question for Dominic. It's kind of crazy, but kind of embarrassing, but I'm dying to know. So if he can answer this, I have an occurring dream. It happens to me. I must have had at least, I kid you not, Dominic, probably at least 100 or so of these dreams. I know this sounds crazy and sick. It's not what I want, but it just happens. I have occurring sexual dreams about my cousin.
About your cousin?
Yes. I mean, like, all the time. And I even wake up sometimes, Dominic, thinking that it's real, that it really happened. And it's crazy, and it's just I'm glad this discussion came up because because this is really, it's been bothering me for quite some time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's give it a try. 100 times or more. That's a lot. Now, I suppose at some point, Dominic, as you have a dream that many times, it's got to have some deeper meaning, wouldn't you think?
Well, my profession isn't to interpret dreams, and frankly, we generally work on the process of dreaming versus trying to get into somebody's head necessarily. But we all have sexual dreams. They're quite common, and there's nothing to be embarrassed about in the fact that the same individual shows up. I hear some guilt and concern about it, but it's not that person. It may be aspects of that person that you find attractive, maybe erotic, I don't know. But I don't think necessarily it's unhelpful. In the dream, it's in the privacy of your own dream space, and therefore, you're not acting out on it. So at a very high level, I wouldn't say there's a problem with it. On the other hand, as Art said, there are things below that you may want to work with. Now, if you were practicing lucid dreaming, we basically say, don't avoid it. Get into the dream, not into the physical aspect necessarily, but there's something, a message that the dream character is trying to bring to you, and apparently she's bringing it back again and again and again. It may be the symbol of unobtainable...
Now, wait a minute. She's bringing it back again and again, or he's bringing it back again?
Not she, the cousin. She, the dream figure, which is a representation of a part of you or something down below that your subconscious is bringing up as symbolized by this cousin. Okay, it may be the symbol of unrequited love, or it might be unobtainable femininity. We don't know really what it is. I can't interpret it without knowing Jeff really well. And in fact, Jeff is probably the very best one to eventually understand what this means. But the way that I suggest that, if you were working through a lucid dreaming process, we'd sit down and say, all right, let's see if we can reproduce this dream while we become aware of the fact we're dreaming while this cousin is there, instead of jumping in the sack like we've done 100 times. We'd say, okay.
All right, Dominic, hold it right there. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Well, I'm going to ask Dominic a question that I've always wanted to ask somebody like Dominic, and that is his opinion, his honest, unvarnished opinion of dream interpreters. Now, sometimes we have them on the radio, and what I've noticed is that inevitably, maybe this is a dream interpreter's job, I don't know, but if you describe dream A, it absolutely never has anything to do with what was actually in the dream. For example, you dream about climbing Mount Everest. Well, it turns out you're actually dreaming about your car according to the dream interpreter. It's always driven me crazy. So we'll ask what he thinks of dream interpreters in a moment. Well, all right. Dominic, welcome back. I really have always wanted to ask about this. You know, from time to time, we have these dream interpreters that come on the radio, and I don't know, it's like psychic readings or something. What do you think of them?
Well, let me first say that, you know, psychiatrists have used dream work for a long time to get into the mind and try to understand underlying pressures that may be giving people problems. And I think there's some value in that, especially for professionals who've been doing it, you know, their whole lives, and understanding the science and its limitations. And I do think, you know, when you talk about archetypes and general motifs across the population, there are things that we can understand. The idea of unity, as Steve was saying earlier, and ecstasy. I think those things are valid. But I think when it comes to personal readings and interpretations of a specific dream,
yes,
I think the best interpreter is the dreamer himself. And that's why with Jeff's earlier dream or any other dream that's either worrisome or just an enigma to the dreamer, the thing to do is to try to, I think, if it's not lucid, do some free association on paper. How did you feel? What were the impressions that came through? Much the way a psychiatrist would do with an individual who's being treated for something. But if you go through the practice of lucid dreaming, in the dream, you can oftentimes work with the dream characters, which we believe to be mostly aspects of our mind or the representations of the dream director, and simply ask the dream character, what is it you're trying to tell me?
So perhaps the answer to what your dream means might be in developing the ability to lucidly dream.
Let's say technique you can use to understand and interpret your dreams in real time while you're in the dream. And you can work strategies to try to address issues. Recurring dreams like Jeff's or nightmares oftentimes show there is some underlying issue, trauma, worry, concern, guilt, and you can spend years in psychoanalysis trying to uncover what that is. On the other hand, if you have a recurring dream, it's an opportunity to try something new in the dream and see if you can hit upon a strategy that resolves the issue. In Stephen's books, there are various accounts of cyclical recurring dreams where, yeah, in fact, strategies are developed in real time in lucid dreams in order to resolve them. So not just for interpretation, but for resolution, I highly recommend personal dream work where you take command and control of interpreting your own dreams, since they are yours, not somebody else's.
All right. Peggy in Colorado, you're on the air with Dominic. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, I frequently remember my dreams, and they're mostly all positive. And in particular, I will dream about, or I will think, or have my dad on my mind during the day. And the next night or the next morning, I wake up and remember a dream that I've had with him. And oftentimes, I think of a question that I would like to ask him. He's no longer with us. And I wonder if I practice your technique, can I ask him that question and work that way?
Sure you can. In fact, I highly recommend it. You know, especially when there is pining, longing for a person who's passed on or just no longer around, somebody overseas, parts of a relationship.
But Dominic, you take no position on whether it's actually her father answering or her mind providing the answer, right?
Yeah. And I was evasive with you before when you touched upon this topic, because I really don't think it makes a difference if we're trying to find a wholesome emotional balance.
Right.
And I personally don't think it's important to make the judgment, is it really the spirit of that person or the spirit within you that remembers that person? Because I think to the individual, they're one and the same. In terms
that
of the greater
so,
question.
That is so exciting to me, because it is a longing for a relationship that is gone. And I think of questions that I would have asked him had I thought of the questions before he passed away. And that's very exciting to me, and I'm excited about learning your technique. Thank you so much.
It's very much like the story I told you earlier with my wife, one of my partners at Lucidity Institute, Key Lin, who jointly teaches the program with myself and Stephen, has many, many cases of family members and friends of hers who have passed on, and she continually goes back to have another life with them at times to expand their relationships, whether they be inside her or in the greater ether. Like I said, it's not really important to me if you make that judgment, if it's wholesome for you and brings you better balance and enjoyment in life.
Okay. Charles in Maryland, you're on the air with Dominic.
Yeah. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Just fine.
All right. I'm going to make this kind of quick. I'm at work, and I may get interrupted here. But a while back, when I quit smoking, my doctor put me on a medication called Chantix. And
caller, I also tried that medication.
Okay.
And the main side effect, as I'm sure you're well aware, is a change in dreaming, a very big change.
Oh, yeah. And very vivid dreaming. I mean, extremely vivid, where I could have dreams that seemed like they lasted hours and hours. And when I would wake up, some nights I could remember 10 and 12 dreams.
Yes.
I mean, almost every single detail of the dreams.
Is this a prescription? I'm not really familiar with it.
Yes, okay, I can help you out. Yes, it is a prescription medication.
Yeah.
To assist in quitting smoking, and in all the literature on this medication, they say the number one side effect is a change, they say, in dreaming. Now, I agree with this caller. I tried it, and to be honest with you, Dominic, I had such intense dreaming that I discontinued the medication.
Oh, you should join us. More dreams. Now, let me make a general comment. It sounds to me like a replacement for nicotine, smoking cessation.
No. It's not a replacement. Patches and nicotine gum and things like that are a replacement.
Yeah.
This goes to work on some part of the brain that I'm not particularly familiar with, but it's not a replacement for nicotine. I promise you that. It has some other effect on the brain.
No, what I was going to get at was not that it's a nicotinic supplement. I was going to say some research we've done with herbal supplements suggests that there are some receptors in the mind, one of them called a nicotinic receptor, that if excited correctly, allows not only better focus and memory, but it's also associated with lucidity. Now, we weren't working with the substance you're talking about, but a different class of neurotransmitter enhancers, acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, in fact. One of them has a dual mode that it increases acetylcholine, but more importantly in this case, also excites the nicotinic receptors. And we found that to be very helpful in not just extending REM sleep, but enhancing lucidity for those who need a booster.
Okay, let me just interrupt you, Dominic, and ask the caller. Caller, how did you do with it as time went on? Because I kind of bailed out fairly quickly as this intense dreaming began. It actually bothered me. I didn't like it.
Yeah, okay. After I actually quit smoking, the dreams went away. But until I quit, they continued. So while I was smoking, while taking the medication, I kept having them. But after I quit, the dreams went away. Instantly.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you now discontinued the medication?
No, I'm still taking it. No dreams at all.
Okay. Well, very good. All right. You might want to look into this Chantix, Dominic. He's absolutely right. I experienced the same thing. My God, the dreaming was heavy.
It sounds interesting. I also mentioned to Stephen. Like I said, we've been working on the fringe with other substances, so this might be a good one for us to take an extra look at.
Okay, take a look on the web. It'll tell you all about it. Pat in Arkansas, you're on with Dominic. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I used to lucid dream all the time, and when I was real young, I would even plan what I wanted to dream.
Mm-hmm.
But anymore, I sleep very heavily. And do you have any techniques for raising your wave pattern? Because mine goes so deep that when it comes back up, it doesn't get back up to REM.
Well, what do you do for work? Are you lead a busy life?
Well, no, actually, I'm retired, so I don't have a busy life.
So I'm just trying to get a feel for your sleep patterns. Do you get up at your own pace? Does your partner get you up in the morning? Do you use an alarm clock?
Well, I'm a widow, so I sleep when I feel like it, and okay. I wake up when I feel like it.
Right. Well, I'd say that one of the most important things is to get a lot of sleep if you want to work on lucid dreaming. Now, it so happens that adolescents seem to be the ones who have the easiest time at dream sleep, and we think it has a lot to do with peaking of melatonin and other neurotransmitters. There are supplements that can be taken, but I wouldn't advise taking them until you've tried actually working at trying to remember your dreams. I'm pretty sure you're in REM sleep. Everybody is every night, unless they have a real sleep malady. If, in fact, you have a abnormal sleep pattern and therefore be diagnosed as having a sleep sickness, you'd see a doctor and work on that problem first. But generally speaking, in the morning, for most people who go to bed around 11 o'clock, if you get up at 6:30 or 7 with the intention then of going back to sleep a little later on, you can generally catch the last REM cycle. That's the most productive one if you want to practice lucid dreaming.
Well, I have lucid dreamed before. I mean,
Yeah, she's just saying her sleep patterns have changed, so she's now heavily sleeping. So.
Right,
and so maybe I'll just try that because try going back to sleep afterwards.
Yeah.
I used to do it all the time, though. That's why I was.
It was easier for me when I was 15, 16, 17. It was pretty easy in my 20s. It's a little more effortful now, but I've practiced it a lot, so I know basically where the triggers are at. One of the techniques we teach at Dream Camp, it's probably the most powerful one, is to get up after 3 or 4 sleep cycles. Now, a sleep cycle is about 90 minutes long. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're saying if you go to bed at midnight, get up around 4:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. Not with the intention of staying up. Get up for a half hour to 45 minutes. Set your intention. Maybe read a book about lucid dreaming or something that you enjoy. Watching a really mind-expanding cartoon like Gumby. Something that inspires you. And then go back to bed with the intention of dreaming and trying to remember that you're dreaming. It's fundamentally a technique Stephen calls MILD, which is an acronym, the mnemonic induction of lucid dreams. It's available on the website. That in combination with this interrupted sleep method is probably the most powerful one I can give you over the radio to try. But it takes a little bit of practice, and it does require that you kind of disrupt your sleep with the intention of then going back for a nap. Basically, what you're doing is setting up a paradox state where your body wants to jump back into sleep and into REM, mm-hmm. but you've already woken yourself up. So your neurotransmitters and brain waves are up and awake, and yet your body craves that last hour and a half or 2 hours of sleep. So as you transition back in, it's a perfect time to practice.
I've had some wonderful dreams, Dominic, but what do you say to somebody like me
mm-hmm.
who is happiest when he has a little slice of death? In other words, when he goes to sleep, sleeps deeply, mm-hmm. wakes up feeling as though he's had a wonderful night of sleep, in fact has had a wonderful night of sleep, and didn't have any dreams he remembers.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, Art. I mean, that's a perfectly valid way to live your life, as long as you don't want to explore and use the other 2 hours a day of consciousness that's really available to you. And I would encourage anybody to try it. It can be, if you have the orientation of it's going to be work, I think you recall the dream that was very busy, well, then it's not restful. That's not necessarily how lucid dreams are, although they can be if that's the focus and attitude you take to them. So I find them to be very restful, but I go into the lucid spa as opposed to the lucid work setting.
Okay. John in Long Island, you're on with Dominic. Hi.
Hello, Art. How are you doing, Dominic? My
Pretty
question
good. I'm
is,
from Long Island, too, you know.
That's it. The best place to live in.
Yeah.
My question is, how come dreams seem to dissipate from memory so quickly, say 2 or 3 hours after you're up, unless it's a real vivid dream?
Yeah.
How about 15 or 20 minutes, or by the time you're out of the shower?
So Stephen started to explain some of the theory behind that from an evolutionary standpoint. I touched upon the concept of state-dependent memory. Think of it this way. When you're wide awake now, your brain is working at a certain beat rate. let's say it's beta level brain waves. Your neurotransmitters are moving quite well. Your left and your right brain are on, firing on both sides. In sleep, parts of the brain tend to be more shut down. The neurotransmitters have shifted. You have hormones changing. And there's a certain state of consciousness that shifts throughout the night. So let's say an hour before you get up in the morning, you're in state A. As you change gears and get up and you're in state A for awake, your state has changed. We found that people who, for example, let's say do marijuana, right? A lot of times when they do marijuana, they change their state of consciousness. They have some great thoughts. The next morning, they may not remember them. Once they get high a second time, the thoughts can come back, state-dependent memory. Same thing occasionally with people who drink, right? They change the neurobiology of their body and may or may not be able to recall subtleties they can then recall once they're back in that state. So one of the problems we think is as you get up in the morning, you shift states and the memories become very, very ephemeral after you've shifted. That's why I recommend that if you want to capture your dreams when you're beginning to wake up in the morning, don't move. That physical movement breaks the state as you activate the body.
Okay. All right. So short on time. Wish we had more of it. Gregory in California, you're on the air with Dominic.
Hi, Dominic. How you doing? Great.
Good.
Hey, you know, I really appreciate all your work, especially Stephen LaBerge. When I was 16, I found his book in Lucid Dreaming at I just loved it, and I've been doing it for about 20 years now and got pretty good at it.
Excellent.
The one thing I really am stumped on, and I tried it a number of times, but it's a very difficult process. I know that lucid dreaming happens during your REM period, and that's not your first stage of sleep. However, I've been almost successful in going from completely waking stage directly into a lucid dream situation. Do you have any suggestions or do you have any experience in that? Where
sure.
That is impossible?
Okay, it's going to have to be a very quick answer. Go ahead.
Okay. That's generally called a wild waking initiated lucid dream.
Wow.
You generally transition through hypnagogia, and sometimes you can get a short period of REM. So I would suggest the time to do that is late in the afternoon. Napping around 3 or 4 in the afternoon is good for your biorhythms.
Okay. It has been such a pleasure to have the two of you on. Dominic, you've really been something, and we're going to have you back again. Is there a website people can look at?
Yeah, www.lucidity.com. There's a lot of material up there, both scientific research and excerpts from Stephen's books. And, of course, our Lucid Dreaming Boot Camp is coming up in April, and the details are posted on the site as well.
All at the website. All right, Dominic, thank you for being here, my friend, and good night.
Thank you very much, Art. Good night.
Take care. And for all the rest of you, have a great night's sleep and do all the lucid dreaming you can muster up. From the high desert, I'll see you tomorrow night. Good night, all.